Chapter 6. The Non-Commercial. Reardon pressed his forehead to the mirror and tried not to think. That was the only way he could go through with it, he told himself. He concentrated on the relief of the mirror's cooling touch, wondering how one went about forcing one's mind into blankness, particularly after a lifetime lived on the axiom that the constant, clearest, most ruthless function of his rational faculty was his foremost duty. He wondered why no effort had ever seemed beyond his capacity, yet now he could not scrape up the strength to stick a few black pearl studs into his starched white shirt front. This was his wedding anniversary, and he had known for 3 months that the party would take place tonight, as Lillian wished. He had promised it to her, safe in the knowledge that the party was a long way off, and that he would attend to it when the time came, as he attended to every duty on his overloaded schedule. Then, during 3 months of 18-hour workdays, he had forgotten it happily. Until half an hour ago, when long past dinner time, his secretary had entered his office and said firmly, "Your party, Mr. Reardon." He had cried, "Good God!" leaping to his feet. He had hurried home, rushed up the stairs, started tearing his clothes off, and gone through the routine of dressing, conscious only of the need to hurry, not of the purpose. When the full realization of the purpose struck him like a sudden blow, he stopped. "You don't care for anything but business," he had heard it all his life, pronounced as a verdict of damnation. He had always known that business was regarded as some sort of secret, shameful cult, which one did not impose on innocent laymen, that people thought of it as an ugly necessity, to be performed but never mentioned, that to talk shop was an offense against higher sensibilities, that just as one washed machine grease off one's hands before coming home, so one was supposed to wash the stain of business off one's mind before entering a drawing room. He had never held that creed, but he had accepted it as natural that his family should hold it. He took it for granted, wordlessly, in the manner of a feeling absorbed in childhood, left unquestioned and unnamed, that he had dedicated himself, like the martyr of some dark religion, to the service of a faith which was his passionate love, but which made him an outcast among men, whose sympathy he was not to expect. He had accepted the tenet that it was his duty to give his wife some form of existence unrelated to business, but he had never found the capacity to do it, or even to experience a sense of guilt. He could neither force himself to change, nor blame her if she chose to condemn him. He had given Lillian none of his time for months. No, he thought, for years, for the 8 years of their marriage. He had no interest to spare for her interests, not even enough to learn just what they were. She had a large circle of friends, and he had heard it said that their names represented the heart of the country's culture. But he had never had time to meet them, or even to acknowledge their fame by knowing what achievements had earned it. He knew only that he often saw their names on the magazine covers on newsstands. If Lillian resented his attitude, he thought, she was right. If her manner toward him was objectionable, he deserved it. If his family called him heartless, it was true. He had never spared himself in any issue. When a problem came up at the mills, his first concern was to discover what error he had made. He did not search for anyone's fault but his own. It was of himself that he demanded perfection. He would grant himself no mercy now. He took the blame. But at the mills, it prompted him to action, in an immediate impulse to correct the error. Now it had no effect. Just a few more minutes, he thought, standing against the mirror, his eyes closed. He could not stop the thing in his mind that went on throwing words at him. It was like trying to plug a broken hydrant with his bare hands. Stinging jets, part words, part pictures, kept shooting at his brain. Hours of it, he thought. Hours to spend watching the eyes of the guests, getting heavy with boredom if they were sober, or glazing into an imbecile stare if they weren't, and pretend that he noticed neither, and strained to think of something to say to them when he had nothing to say, while he needed hours of inquiry to find a successor for the superintendent of his rolling mills who had resigned suddenly without explanation. He had to do it at once. Men of that sort were so hard to find. And if anything happened to break the flow of the rolling mills, it was the Taggart rail that was being rolled. He remembered the silent reproach, the look of accusation, long-bearing patience and scorn, which he always saw in the eyes of his family when they caught some evidence of his passion for his business, and the futility of his silence, of his hope that they would not think Reardon Steele meant as much to him as it did, like a drunkard pretending indifference to liquor, among people who watch him with the scornful amusement of their full knowledge of his shameful weakness. "I heard you last night coming home at 2 in the morning. Where were you?" his mother saying to him at the dinner table, and Lillian answering, "Why, at the mills, of course," as another wife would say, "at the corner saloon." Or Lillian asking him, the hint of a wise half-smile on her face, "What were you doing in New York yesterday?" "It was a banquet with the boys."
"Business?"
"Yes."
"Of course."
And Lillian turning away, nothing more, except the shameful realization that he had almost hoped she would think he had attended some sort of obscene stag party. An ore carrier had gone down in a storm on Lake Michigan with thousands of tons of Reardon ore. Those boats were falling apart. If he didn't take it upon himself to help them obtain the replacements they needed, the owners of the line would go bankrupt, and there was no other line left in operation on Lake Michigan. "That nook," said Lillian, pointing to an arrangement of settees and coffee tables in their drawing room. "Why, no, Henry, it's not new, but I suppose I should feel flattered that 3 weeks is all it took you to notice it. It's my own adaptation of the morning room of a famous French palace. But things like that can't possibly interest you, darling. There's no stock market quotation on them. None whatever." The order for copper, which he had placed 6 months ago, had not been delivered. The promised date had been postponed 3 times. "We can't help it, Mr. Reardon." He had to find another company to deal with. The supply of copper was becoming increasingly uncertain. Philip did not smile when he looked up in the midst of a speech he was making to some friend of their mother's about some organization he had joined. But there was something that suggested a smile of superiority in the loose muscles of his face when he said, "No, you wouldn't care for this. It's not business, Henry. Not business at all. It's a strictly non-commercial endeavor." That contractor in Detroit, with the job of rebuilding a large factory, was considering structural shapes of Reardon metal. He should fly to Detroit and speak to him in person. He should have done it a week ago. He could have done it tonight. "You're not listening," said his mother at the breakfast table, when his mind wandered to the current coal price index, while she was telling him about the dream she'd had last night. "You've never listened to a living soul. You're not interested in anything but yourself. You don't give a damn about people, not about a single human creature on God's earth." The typed pages lying on the desk in his office were a report on the tests of an airplane motor made of Reardon metal. Perhaps of all things on earth, the one he wanted most at this moment was to read it. It had lain on his desk, untouched, for 3 days. He had had no time for it. Why didn't he do it now? And he shook his head violently, opening his eyes, stepping back from the mirror. He tried to reach for the shirt studs. He saw his hand reaching instead for the pile of mail on his dresser. It was mail picked as urgent. It had to be read tonight. But he had had no time to read it in the office. His secretary had stuffed it into his pocket on his way out. He had thrown it there while undressing. A newspaper clipping fluttered down to the floor. It was an editorial which his secretary had marked with an angry slash in red pencil. It was entitled, "Equalization of Opportunity." He had to read it. There had been too much talk about this issue in the last 3 months. Ominously too much. He read it with the sound of voices and forced laughter coming from downstairs, reminding him that the guests were arriving, that the party had started, and that he would face the bitter, reproachful glances of his family when he came down. The editorial said that at a time of dwindling production, shrinking markets, and vanishing opportunities to make a living, it was unfair to let one man hoard several business enterprises while others had none. It was destructive to let a few corner all the resources, leaving others no chance. Competition was essential to society, and it was society's duty to see that no competitor ever rose beyond the range of anybody who wanted to compete with him. The editorial predicted the passage of a bill which had been proposed, a bill forbidding any person or corporation to own more than one business concern. Wesley Mooch, his Washington man, had told Reardon not to worry. The fight would be stiff, he had said, but the bill would be defeated. Reardon understood nothing about that kind of fight. He left it to Mooch and his staff.
He could barely find time to skim through their reports from Washington and to sign the checks which Mooch requested for the battle.